I'm Betty Salonik, CEO and founder of Accelerate Investors. Welcome to our podcast, Chief Investment Officer Conversations, which brings to you what is on top of mind for the world's leading CIOs. In our conversations, we will explore their background, their current investment strategies, and their global outlook. Welcome to part one of my interview with Kim Liu, CEO of the $14 billion-plus Columbia University Endowment. In this episode, Kim discusses with us the structural and cultural changes she has implemented since she joined Columbia in November 2020. Kim also discusses investment lessons from her time at the Ford Foundation and Carnegie Corporation that she has taken with her into her role at Columbia. And she also shares the most significant impact she would like to make in her role at Columbia University. Before we start, I invite you to join us at the Accelerate Investors Midwest Investor Insights Summit on September 29th in Chicago. At the summit, you will have the opportunity to meet chief investment officers and other allocators from the Midwest region. For more information, please visit accelerateinvestorsny.com/MW22. The link is also in the episode description. Now, on to today's conversation. I hope you enjoy. Good morning, Kim. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. I'm so excited to be here today. It's a privilege for me and an honor. Thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me and sit down for this conversation.
Oh, I'm excited to do it, and I'm sorry it took so long to make this happen, but I'm glad we're doing it now.
Better late than never, so thank you for making it happen. Why don't we begin with you sharing with us who you are and what you do?
So I am the Chief Executive Officer and President of the Columbia Investment Management Company. My name is Kim Liu, and I am born and raised here in New York City. And so it's really good to have built my career here in my home. And for sure to be working, I've worked now at two organizations that have New York in its names, Columbia University in the city of New York and Carnegie Corporation of New York. So I feel really proud of that.
It's amazing. I love New York City. I'm not from here, but it's my home now, and I love it. Maybe we can step back a bit before we dive further into the conversation and hear more about your career history and what drew you to Columbia.
So when I first graduated from college, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. I graduated and I joined Chemical Bank in their credit training program, which was an amazing opportunity back in the day. Back then, banks would dedicate a significant amount of time and resources to train you. So I went through a 9-month training program. I don't think any of the banks would invest that much in developing talent at this point, which is unfortunate. But I also think that people don't stay as long, so I understand it. I spent 3 years at Chemical Bank, and then I went back to Harvard Business School. And when I graduated, I joined Prudential Capital Group. It was a really tough time. It was the private placement group of Prudential Insurance Company. But it was right after the Iraq War. Things were really challenging. The markets had collapsed. Insurance companies were taking off risk. So it wasn't exactly the job that I thought I was going to have. And for a variety of reasons, including a lot of instability at the organization at the time, I felt like I should move on. And a friend of mine suggested that I speak to his mom, who was at the Ford Foundation. I didn't know anything about foundation management at the time, and actually joined the foundation thinking I was going to become part of the program side, not necessarily a part of the investment side. I'd grown up in disadvantaged neighborhoods and felt like I would join the economic development group at the Ford Foundation and learn to sort of support my neighborhoods. But then I started doing what I did at Ford Foundation and loved it. And, wow. You know, a new career was born. And I think I found it in a really unexpected way. I didn't go at it thinking that that was my lifelong goal. I'm always surprised now when I hear from young people who reach out to me who say, I have known, you know, since college that I wanted to do endowment management. I was like, I didn't even know endowment management existed in college, let Same alone know me. That that was something I wanted to do. But 13 years at the Ford Foundation, 13 years at Carnegie Corporation of New York, and in November of 2020, I joined Columbia.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that background. You've been CEO at Columbia for about 2 years now. What are some of the most significant changes you've implemented as CEO?
So, I want to start out by saying, I said that one of the things that is true, I think, of every new leader of an investment organization is that there's bound to be some change, because you have to tailor an organization that you lead to a style that you can execute on effectively. And so I joined Columbia having taken over leadership from two people who had a very strong background in history and hedge funds, and particularly in sort of trading strategies at hedge funds. And the bulk of my history in investing had been in private markets. And so while I have a lot of respect for the role of hedge funds, and I think it's an incredibly important part of the portfolio, I also cared a lot about the private markets and feel like that's an area that can be a great place for people who have very long-term capital and expect to operate in perpetuity to invest. I always think of the portfolios that we invest in at foundations and endowments as two parts. There's the part that is for current needs, and there's the part for future needs, because we are stewards of the future when we invest our capital. And so I think private assets are an amazing way to think about developing a portfolio that services the future needs of the organization. And so when I joined, the first things I wanted to do was reposition the private's portfolio and really think about ways to develop it so that it was a world-class portfolio. I had to step back and think about whether the organization was set up in such a way that it could do that. And there are things that were present in the way it was constructed that I did not think fit my style. And I thought because it didn't fit my style, it would make it difficult for us to build a successful privates portfolio. So just for example, it was set up as a generalist model. Mm-hmm. And I think generalist models can work really effectively in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. What it requires is a CIO, a CEO, who feels very confident making the final decision in everything, mm-hmm. and feels like they feel that they are prepared to dedicate all of their time and resources to investing. Because in order to be incredibly good at that, you have to dedicate a lot of time and resources mm-hmm. to it. But I, often think that part of my job as a CIO, CEO is to make sure that I manage stakeholders. And so I can't dedicate all of my time to investing. And so I have to delegate some of the responsibilities that I ultimately have mm-hmm. to the team. And in order for me to delegate it to the team, I had to make sure that I'd given the team responsibilities and ownership over certain parts of the portfolio. And so I went from having a completely generalist model to having the senior most people at the team being specialists and keeping the junior people as generalists. And, a big part of that is that I think that in order to build a really effective private portfolio, you have to decide what you want it to look like ultimately and then wait for the fat pitch. You're not responding to what comes to you at any moment. You're designing a program. And when the things that fit your design come to you, you invest in them. Mm-hmm. And so I think as a result, someone has to be thinking about that all the time. Someone has to be dedicating resources to cultivating relationships in that market, making sure they always see everything that comes, mm-hmm. making sure that they understand the trade-offs that you have to make. And so as soon as you have people focused and specializing in the private markets, you also have to have somebody who specializes in the public markets, because the public markets has to increasingly become responsive to what's mm-hmm. going on in the private market. Because the more you do in privates, the more unfunded, a greater liability you have, your liquidity needs change on the public side. So all these types of things happen. And so one of the first things I had to decide was, what about the generalist model I thought I should preserve and what parts I thought were not mm-hmm. going to be effective going forward so that we could build this portfolio of the future that was important to me? One of the things I thought I really loved about the generalist model, and particularly about the way Columbia did things, because we weren't asset allocators, we were risk allocators. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a policy portfolio. And I think that one of the things that can happen when you have a portfolio, a policy portfolio, is that people end up just trying to fill the buckets, right? And you know that you need to have this much in mm-hmm. privates, and so you think about how to fill that up. Or you know you need this much in public, I mean, whatever. And you know you can get things in by doing that. And, you know, it sort of makes it more challenging for creative things to get into the portfolio, especially if they don't fit neatly into mm-hmm. one of these buckets. Yeah. And it also makes it more challenging to assess managers that are starting to do everything. So I like the fact that there was elements of the way it was set up that allowed for more creativity, I think, and allows for the ability to handle the way the market is changing. And so I wanted to preserve that, but I also wanted to make sure that we were being very strategic about how we developed the portfolio. So that's probably the first thing I did. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about what the private portfolio should look like, how big it should be, how we should allocate capital over time. Thankfully, there weren't that many years before the market has now come undone. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't do a ton yeah. before now. I think this is a really good time to be an early investor in privates, because the best time to invest is not when the market is good, is when the market is bad, yeah. and to exit when the market is good. And so, right. you know, probably in a year will be a really good time to have capital in private markets. And so we're looking at ways to develop and build relationships with the people we know. We know a lot of our peers are a little over their skis in privates. And so the fact that we will have capital yeah. and the ability to invest, I think, right. will give us the ability to get access to some of the great managers. So a lot of what I did was structural,
yeah.
really rethinking some of the ways that it was done in the past. All of them, I think, very interesting and completely appropriate for the prior leadership. And it, because I think about the portfolio differently, we just had to reorganize. And we also had to think about what kind of reports we needed that were different, and how mm-hmm. we looked at the portfolio had to change. And so it's a lot of structural things that needed to change, quite honestly. And so there was a lot of energy focused on that for the last couple of years. Culture shifts, changing the way how people viewed bringing value, how one of the questions I always ask managers is what creates social capital in your organization? Yeah. And I think a lot of places it's getting names in the book. So we had to step back and say, no, it's not about getting names in the book. It's about getting, improving the quality of the portfolio. It's just as important to decide not to do something as to do something, and to really congratulate people when they can step back and say, this is not the right thing for the mm-hmm. portfolio. So all of that challenging in the midst of a pandemic yeah. when you're not in the office all the right. time. So I think it's gone slower than I might have liked, but I think slow and steady and incredibly conscious of making and bringing everybody along.
That's great. And you've worked at other top organizations. What investment lessons from your time at the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Corporation, have you taken into this role at Columbia?
So I think that the one of the great benefits that I had working at those two organizations specifically is just the breadth mm-hmm. of things I got to see. So they think about investing very differently, at least when I was at the two different organizations. So when I was at the Ford Foundation, they took a very traditional approach. Were not a lot of alternatives in the portfolio. In fact, the CIO at the time felt really strongly that she could replicate in the public markets anything that could be done in the private markets. Mm-hmm. It was also a big organization. It was at the time the largest foundation. And so it was relatively large, very siloed in the approach to investing. So there was a internally managed publics team. There was an external publics team. There was a privates team. None of those talked to each other. And I don't mean in a bad way. I just mean like each one set their own strategy and managed their own portfolio, including the fact that the privates team managed its own cash. So a very siloed approach. Then I went to Carnegie, much smaller, right? So at the time, I think that Ford was maybe in the $12 billion range, something like that, maybe 10 or 12 billion. Carnegie was 2.5, I think, when I got there. So very different size organizations. But it was, everybody was involved in every investment decision. It was much more of a collaborative way of investing. Lots of alternatives. The CIO prior to me and who hired me into Carnegie was a Davis Winston acolyte, was one of the Yale pups, and felt very much really, really loved the endowment model that was developed by Yale. And so it followed that model. And so I got to see two very, very different ways of managing capital, and I got to see what things about it were challenging and which things about it really worked. And I think that there are elements of the traditional model that gives you tons of liquidity, gives you tons of optionality. You can be very tactical. You can really, if you feel like that those skills are resonant with you, it gives you lots of levers that you can pull. And I would argue that the Ford Foundation was closer to like the way Harvard managed money at the time, right? And so Carnegie was much closer to the way Yale managed money at the time. And so, so on the other hand, Carnegie really, because it embraced the endowment model, really thought much more about efficiencies, about long-term trends, about long-term strategies, far less tactical. In fact, because they invested it in so many illiquid assets, it reduces your ability to be tactical. So, but I do think that if you consistently execute on both of those strategies and you have the team that can do both of those strategies, either can be successful in their own way. So I got to see that and got to pay attention to what I think best fit who I was and as an investor and how I thought about things. I think that going forward, you have to be... look, honestly, I probably embrace the endowment model a little bit more because I do think there's a lot of noise in investing. And so if you can be strategic and think through the noise, mm-hmm. you can make a lot of good investments. And also it takes the emotion out of it. Sometimes you can get wrapped up in the emotions of the market because so much of it really is about the psychology of how people think as opposed to actual value. And I think the endowment model allows you to step back from that a little bit. But one of the things I think the new iteration of investing is going to be is to really focus on your institution, the skills, the knowledge your institution brings, the access your institution brings, and the needs of your institution. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not going to be so blanket the way it's been in the past. And people are really going to have to think about what your institution can handle. And it's going to be a combination of different things that are not going to be the same from institution to institution. And so I'm spending a lot of time really getting to know Columbia and trying to make sure I understand what its needs are. Mm-hmm. I'm operating in an incredibly complex university in New York City with all the challenges of being in New York City. You know, so many schools, so many students. It has a larger population than most of the other Ivies for sure and most of the schools in this area. It's also, you know, it has a healthcare system, so many challenges around the healthcare system. You know, it has a huge real estate portfolio that it thinks about in different ways than some of the other institutions think about their real estate portfolio. I think higher education is being called into question right now. So, you know, I'm working at an organization that is in the midst of a lot of, the right word is just change. There's just a lot of change going on in the markets, in the industry, in the city. And so being conscious of that and trying to create stability in some ways is a different thing than if you are managing an endowment in a small town with only 5,000 students who, you know, it's just I think you can do very different things. And I think we're going to have to all be increasingly conscious of what our individual institutions need.
Thanks for that. What is the most significant impact you would like to make as CEO of Columbia's endowment? And you spoke what a big university it is and it's in a global city.
Yeah. So, you know, Columbia is an amazing place. It has educated some of the most admired people in the world. I think that I would love to say that I contribute to continuing to support its mission. You know, I never lose sight of the fact that the investment arm of these not-for-profits are support functions, mm-hmm. right? We are here to serve the mission of these organizations. And I think probably that grows out of the fact that I spent most of my life at foundations. Mm-hmm. And it's very loud and very clear what the mission is. I think similarly, Columbia has a very clear mission about what it's trying to accomplish. And I want ultimately for it to be said that the investment office played a role in making it do all the things, meet all the goals that it set for itself, because it has very ambitious goals about, it wants to solve the climate issue. It wants to be sort of at the precipice of dealing with global conflicts and things like that. It feels very passionately about journalism and the role that journalism plays in society. So there's so many things where Columbia sits at the cusp of things that are really important in this world right now. And I want to think to myself that I played a role in supporting the work that they're doing. So I think that historically, the investment management company has been very distant from the university. I'd like to bring it a little closer to the university. Mm-hmm. I'd like to build a portfolio that is able to meet the needs now and in the future, and has the flexibility to change as the institution changes, because mm-hmm. I do think they evolve over time, and you have to leave yourself ability to evolve with the institution and be able to support it as it changes. So I'm hoping also that I build an amazing team. I feel like especially the team at Carnegie were filled with truly amazing individuals, and I feel very proud of the fact that they've gone on to lead organizations. I hope that happens here too. You know, I hope that I'm able to create an environment where talent flourishes and people can decide what they want their next step to be, and that I can support that. And, you know, I feel just as proud of anything that I can do to support other not-for-profits that are also doing good work. And so cultivating and training talent that then go on to other places and support other institutions is also super important to me. So I have a lot of big hopes and dreams. We shall see what happens.
Yeah. And I'm curious, you are in a very influential seat with managers who manage billions of dollars, or in some cases, trillions of dollars. Is there a place for Columbia to influence how they invest and maybe bring the university closer, such as with climate change?
It's super interesting. I remember one of the things we used to say all the time when I was at Carnegie is that we punched above our weight. We weren't that big, but we played an important role, or we tried to play an important role. We spent a lot of time sort of cultivating our reputation in the market as being value-added investors who really were trying to be thoughtful and be in good partnership. And in my mind, I always thought a place like Columbia, who's so much bigger, mm-hmm. would have influence by its size. And then you get to Columbia and I think to myself, okay, we have $14 billion, but we don't have CalPERS money. We don't have CalSTRS money. We don't have ADIA's money. We don't have, you know, Japan's money. It's all relative. Mm-hmm. But what I do have is an institution that's well respected, mm-hmm. with a ton of expertise. And so I have to leverage that, mm-hmm. right? Just like we tried to leverage what we had at Carnegie, I have to leverage the fact that we have people, experts working on big problems that our portfolio companies are also trying to work on. Hopefully over time, I'll be able to put together symposiums or conferences or things of that nature that'll give our managers access to this talent at the university. One thing I learned is how much the stakeholders here really care about this institution and want it to be successful. So they are absolutely willing to dedicate some of their time to helping us to help our managers. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten an amazing response from the professors and the administration here who are like, as you think about how you want to build out and how you want to build relationships with managers, if we can be helpful, we're willing to be helpful. I think that's wonderful. I think it just took reaching out and going and trying to talk to them and learning a little bit about what they are doing. I started a lunch and learn series here with managers, just spending 1 hour on Zoom with the team talking about their work and the things that they're doing. And sometimes it's not to talk even about work, but it's just to teach a class that I think might be helpful as we think about our managers and to sort of convey that on and be supportive of them. So I think they're just, like I said, a lot, each of us is going to have to figure out what our resources are that we can offer to managers to make them better. You know, it's getting more complex to do this. And we're going to have to leverage all that in service to our managers, and our managers are going to, I think, probably choose accordingly. So we're trying to be valuable.
Sounds good.
Thank you for listening to part one of my conversation with Kim Liu. Stay tuned for part two. And don't forget to join us on September 29th in Chicago for the Accelerate Investors Midwest Investor Insights Summit. I'm Betty Salonik, founder and CEO of Accelerate Investors, and you've been listening to CIO Conversations. You can follow Accelerate Investors on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thank you for listening.